And while we're sitting here, the Crime Beat reporter is on his way to the 3100 block of Graceland on a report that an individual shot. No indication as to the condition. But I may find out stuff since the men and women of law enforcement are here. 239-1310. 239-1310. We've got two guests, and we'll explain who they are in just a hot second. Let me go to Eric right quick at 239-1310. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Amos, I got two things.
Yeah.
First of all, for the police that are speeding in the cars and stuff like that, we need to come up with some sort of device or something that so they'll, you know, we'll know if they're on a run or if they're not on a run, or if it's, you know what I'm saying, if there's some kind of way that they could monitor that or come up with something like that.
Yeah, he wants to make sure, Chief, that if you focus speed, they ought to be on the run.
Speeding. I mean, I see it happening every day, and it's very seldom that another police pulls over another police. I mean, it happens rarely. So, you know, and they don't have their lights on. They're just flying right past me on the highway. So, you know, who's going to pull them over? So.
Mm-hmm. Every car has a shop number. Sir, if you have a question, we'll gladly answer it. I think the problem is what we have to do is have a real discussion about what is considered the policy around speeding and policing, and also what happens when they get into an accident. It's not very pleasant what happens to a police officer involved in an accident. The accident review board, the process of possibly losing his vehicle and his right to drive for a period of time. So if you see one out driving excessively, there's a shop number on the vehicle. Get the location, the time of day, and give us a number.
And that's the number on the back of the vehicle.
That's the number on the back of the vehicle, in the front of the vehicle.
Okay. And my other thing is for the youth, and since we're having all this crime from the youth, I think that, you know, from when I was a kid, we had a lot of things for us to do. We had Partners 2000. We had a lot of job opportunities for 14-year-olds on up or whatever the age group is to, you know, start working now. And a lot of these teenagers don't have anything to do, and they want to make some money. And the only opportunity, well, the only way that they see of making money now, since they don't have any jobs or anything, is taking from us. So we have to find some sort of avenue, or we have to get some monies together to get another Partners 2000 going. I mean, I think that needs to happen again.
One of the conversations we had with a group of us was to talk about cottage industries in our communities. Remember when we had landscaping in our own neighborhoods, when kids were able to work in the neighborhoods? Why don't we do that? We have resources right in our neighborhood. The things the kids can do to generate resources, we need to go back to that. But at the same time, I think it's a collective responsibility that we find something for them to do. One of the state-of-the-art locations now kids go to is Latitude 39. We're talking about that type of state-of-the-art, because the kids today have more things at home to entertain them than they do in a rec center. So we have to be clear that not every kid's going to go to a rec center. We have to be clear how we engage them in the process.
If you mentioned in that place at Latitude 39, which is up at 82nd and Dean mm-hmm. Road, they have a very strict policy of these are our rules, and if you even think right. of violating the rules, we will throw you out. We don't care whether you're black, white, brown, or yellow, we'll throw you out. If other places were to open up like that in the community, they need to establish their parameters from the get-go.
I agree, and I think the idea of setting the values, mm-hmm. and either you're here to them or you don't. And I think that people will be willing to invest resources in a place like that if people were collectively willing to share that value.
Let me go to Mimi at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. I have three short things. First, I wanted to speak on some of the youth jobs. I have a 16-year-old, very ambitious. I'm very, very proud of him. 10th grade. He just got involved with a place called the Kenny Group. So us as parents / adults, we need to push these kids too. If they're not as ambitious as we, you know, would like them to be or see them being, we have to push them, offer them things, show them things, explain to them how, when, what, where, how, you know, how to get this. And they can avoid the streets, because my son knows the streets is a no-no, and I've been a single parent for a very long time.
Okay.
So we as adults, we got to put them out there. They Google everything else, Google that.
Good point.
So, and another thing, I was told, I haven't been able to listen, but I was told last week, because I didn't know anyone else to call, I called Amos radio station to mention to them about an incident my son had with some young men down the street from our home. We've been here for a year, and he wants to play basketball, him and his friend. Well, the young boys that was already on the basketball court, 15, 16, maybe a little older, got to taunting the boys, asking them where they're from and who you claim, and let me see your phone. They was ignoring him. My son and his friend was ignoring him. Let me see your phone. Took his phone from threatening them about I got a full clip and all of this. So me, being the person that I've been raised to be, I said, okay, I'm going to talk to them first. Mm-hmm. Now I know these are children. I'm calling the police. The police said that they couldn't help me. Why is that? Why, when we had witnesses and pointed out whom and what happened, why did they allow this young man to think that it was okay to do this?
And the phone was actually stolen. Did you get the phone back?
We did not get the phone back. Because, like I said, I'm being an adult. I said, I'm not going to taunt these kids like they just did my son. Because I was ready to turn them upside down. But I have to be an adult, and I have to show my child, you know.
So let me make sure I understand this. So somebody stole your son's cell phone. You called the police to report it, and they wouldn't respond?
No, they came out.
They came out, okay.
When I spoke with the police officer, he told me, oh, all I can do is take a report, and right now we can't call this a theft because it's his word against his word.
Ma'am, let me ask you a question.
Hold on.
The chief wants to ask you a question.
Were both the kids there when the police arrived?
Both the kids were there, but I sent my son's friend, I sent him home. I said, I want permission from your parents before you over here helping us. I don't do that. You're a minor. I don't want you involved in anything. So you go talk to your parents, and they never came back out. But and the parents have a rapport where I could have, if the police officer would have took it there, I would say, okay, let me go knock on the door and ask them, is it okay? He didn't say any of that. He just said, well, right now I can't do anything but make a report. I got his name. He is in juvenile. He's in the system. I said, well, you allow him to go do this again next week.
Well, those are the kind of cases we want to hear about. Ma'am, can you do me a favor? Give it to the engineer. Give me the information offline so we can follow up on that.
So Mimi,
I'd like to hear a little bit more about this. Cause...
Mimi, if you would hold on, and Chris, the gentleman that you talked to when you called me, is going to pick up the phone off the air. And if you would be so kind as to give your name and a number where you can be reached during the day, and they're going to follow up with you, okay?
Okay.
All right. All right. Thank you. 239-1310. 239-1310 this afternoon's name. It's about a month. What was it? About a month, month and a half ago. Director in chief, you all were down at Light of the World Church with a community conversation. And somebody got up and said, you know, people are afraid of calling Crime Stoppers because, you know, everything else gets hacked. And, you know, there's the guy that Brian Williams talked to on television last night that said all our America's secrets to everybody around the world. So if somebody can do that, how do we know that Crime Stoppers is safe? And I think it took a lot of people's breath away, those of us that have been familiar with Crime Stoppers like forever. So Stephen Dubois, director-in-chief, is here. He's the guy with Crime Stoppers. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
How long has Crime Stoppers been around here?
Actually, in December, will be 30 years in the metro area.
You all are 10 years younger than me. 30 years.
30
it got
years.
Started how?
It basically got started by a bunch of city fathers got together, and they decided that they had heard about a Crime Stopper program. It originally started out in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. They got together, and they thought it was a good program. Then IMPD was the sponsoring law enforcement agency, and they just pretty much created a nonprofit to raise the money for the rewards and created the board that directs the program. And off they started. They started January 1 of 1985.
Is Crime Stoppers under the police department, under the Department of Public Safety, under the sheriff? Who are y'all under?
That's a good question. No, I work for the police department, mm-hmm. But the actual program is controlled by a civilian board of directors, just like any other corporation. And they direct how the money is spent, and they raise all the money.
So let me ask, and I mentioned to some people over the Memorial Day holiday that I was going to talk to Crime Stoppers, and they started peppering me with questions. So let's just say, for the sake of the argument, I used this example earlier. Let's say that I heard that Chris was committing a crime. Okay, but I don't want to get involved in Chris knowing that I know that he committed a crime. So I call 262-TIPS. What happens even when I call that number? I've never called it. What happens? Is it an answering machine? Is it a human being I talk to?
Well, most of the time you'll get a human being. Well, okay. All of the time you'll get a human being. If it's through the day, my staff will answer. Mm-hmm. If it's after hours, we have a call center that's in Texas, and all they do is answer for Crime Stopper programs.
Across the country?
Across the country.
That's, so there's this.
Well, actually, they answer for them outside the United States borders. So across the world, this agency.
So the Crime Stoppers is not just here?
No.
It's all over?
Yes.
I could be in Miami, and they got Crime Stoppers?
Yes.
I could be in Rio de Janeiro, and they got Crime Stoppers?
Yes.
Okay. So I call, and I say, hey, I'm calling from Indianapolis. And Chris committed a crime. So then what are they going to ask me? How will they know it's me?
Well, they don't want to know it's you.
Oh, they don't want to know it's
me. No, we don't want to know your name, mm-hmm. and that's the way we keep it. First and foremost, the police need witnesses, and I would emphasize to people that if you are a witness to a crime and you can come forward, come forward. Mm-hmm. That's how we solve homicides, and that's how we solve thefts, and that's how we solve everything. But if there is some reason you can't come forward and you don't want to come forward, this system is anonymous, and we've worked around the technology and we work tirelessly to make sure that we never identify a tipster. So my staff will input whatever we ask you, all sorts of questions, kind of like mini interview. Mm-hmm. We take that information, we put it into
a without election. Asking who I am.
We do not ask you who you are. We give you a code word or phrase. Mm-hmm. That's how we know who you are. Okay. And we will never ask you your name. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to know your name.
So you give me the code phrase, Rosebud. And that would be my phrase.
That would be your phrase.
So then what happens if the information I give you leads to... How does the information then is shared with law enforcement?
Correct.
And so when would I ever find out what happened?
Well, and that's what the way we keep people anonymous. We tell them, we have this little paragraph we read to them and said, since we don't know who you are, you have to call us back to ask about the status of your tip. Now, I will say the communications in the neighborhood is probably far faster than the communication that we have. Mm-hmm. They'll call us back and tell the person was arrested. Mm-hmm. They'll know before we will. Mm-hmm. But when the police department calls us and says, and we work for 18 counties, not just Marion County, but we have an 18-county service area. When they call back and say, this person was arrested, he was arrested for this, and we found a gun, this, that all kind of goes into the reward. Mm-hmm. When that's all done, we put it in the computer. The computer figures up the reward. And when the tipster calls back, then we can pay their reward.
So have there been instances where a tipster, after 2, 3, or 4 years, suddenly says, you know, gee, I wonder what happened to that tip when I called Crime Stoppers. They call Crime Stoppers and say, I'm Rosebud. Have there been instances where, hey, guess what, Rosebud? They found the guys 3 years ago. You got a blessing coming.
Well, we do put a limit on it.
Okay. What's the limit?
The limit, we keep the tips for 1 year.
1 year.
You have 6 months from the point of the arrest. We pay on arrest. We don't pay on conviction.
Okay.
From the point of the arrest to collect your reward. And we tell that to our callers when they call us.
Up front. All right. So it is a year from the time you call. And, you know, hopefully within 6 months of that, they'll get that. And that's it. Have you had instances where people call 4 or 5 years later and say, you cheated me out of this?
Well, they've called, but we've never, because after a year, those tips are gone. We completely eliminate them.
So you don't even know who Rosebud was?
No. And that's part of our process we use to keep the tipsters safe. We don't have 6 years or 10 years or 15 years of tips laying around. They're all gone.
Sarge, if you would, talk about the fact that I think it's significant here in Indy. I find it different. It's interesting that the number of people who actually give information who don't.
Collect the reward.
Exactly.
We have a substantial number. Usually it runs at least 30%, and this year it's running higher. It's probably closer to 60%. So I think what they're using us for is they want to give the information, and they may not want to be known. Mm-hmm. So they use Crime Stoppers as the ability to get the information to the police department for them to act on it. They're just doing the right thing. They're just using us to do it.
So now you know today's popular culture. You know, Agent Gibbs can crack any code and find anybody in 30 seconds. That bald-headed guy on NBC, you know, he can solve any, was it black, whatever, he can find any kind of crime. We know Snowden is selling his soul to the whatever. What protects and keeps hackers and people from going in and breaking that confidentiality? I mean, you all have positioned yourselves almost as ethically as the census. You know, the census says we are not giving up any information, not to the President of the United States, not to the FBI, not to J. Edgar Hoover, not to Agent Gibbs. How do you keep that same level of trust, not only with the American people, but with other countries that Crime Stoppers is operating in?
Well, the first thing is, all of the tips, we don't know who they are. Okay. There may be all these words and everything.
All legal code names.
But we don't know who you are, so we can't give you up if we don't know who you are. Secondly, all of our electronic traffic from our texting, our web traffic, we actually have a mobile app out there. Mm-hmm. All of that runs up to Canada, and it's in a server farm in Canada. Then it shoots back down to Houston, and then it shoots over to us. In Canada, anything that would ID that tipster is taken away, and a code word is attached, a code number. So, and we can actually have two-way communication. So we don't know who it is. They could get into my computer. They could get into everything at Crime Stoppers, and they're still not going to find out who a single tipster is.
Is the fact that Crime Stoppers, the brand, is servicing so many places in this country and other countries, it's to the point where you have to protect that name, because if it goes bad in Indianapolis, you've got the whole world after you.
I will tell you, especially since we're a regional program, if the program in South Bend or the program down in Louisville that covers parts of southern Indiana has a bad incident, it's going to affect me. So that's why we all get together and we talk about best practices and what can we do? I learned from South Bend. I learned from Louisville. I learned from Austin, Texas. We get together once a year, and, hey, has anyone had anything bad happen? Has anyone had anything great happen? Mm-hmm. We're not going to reinvent the wheel. If somebody has figured out a better way to do it, we'll adopt it and we'll go on.
239-13. Now, as Paul Harvey used to say, now you know we're learning things. Chris now feels a little safer. 239-1310. 239-1310 is afternoon's name. Let me go to Anonymous, and then we'll take a break. Hi there.
Yeah, good morning, Amos.
Good morning. What's up?
Well, good afternoon.
Yes.
And hello, Chief Mike. Just got a question. I want to know, I know Crime Stoppers, I've heard, I've been listening, and so I now know that Crime Stoppers is really like separate but affiliated with the police department. But my question is, when we turn in tips, and even though we call back and check on the tips, so, for instance, a drug house, we report a drug house. What is the time frame on trying to bust these drug houses in our neighborhood? Do people come out and watch and look, or is there some kind of procedure? I mean, I know you can't reveal, but just the time frame of trying to get these drug houses out of our neighborhood. Is there something that a certain time frame that is done or kept to get that done?
We're looking at each other because there's two ways I can answer that. I can tell you on one tip, most recently, we had it turned out to be a two-year investigation where $1 million was taken off the streets and a large amount of contraband weapons. But when we had one, within 24 to 48 hours, we were able to make an arrest on it. It depends on the nature of the tip and how much, and when we get into the investigation, where it takes us. We've had at least three tips in the last year of major cases that you've heard of. Where we actually gotten information. If it were not for the public, we wouldn't have known about these individuals and their operation. So it takes us anywhere from 24 hours up to completion of the investigation. It can go from a local simple weed case to a major felony involving spice or methamphetamines, LSD, heroin, etc.
And I got to be real careful with this because I'm coming awful close to tactics and methods.
Yes, sir.
You hear the frustration, chief and director, of people who see the drug house.
Mm-hmm.
Is sometimes part of the delay that perhaps you don't want to take out one little shop when maybe it's more important to take out the whole chain?
That's kind of like the thinking is, if we take off the top, it would stop dealing with the lower level dealers and go with the top. You spiral down to the lower dealers. But what we're finding, though, in communities where we have shots fired, they want immediate action. So you have seen, you will continue to see in the last 2 weeks, an increase of dealing with those low-level dealers who are actually firing shots in our community. We're sending a strong message to those who are at the low-hanging fruit, as we would call them, that either get out of the game, change your life, or find yourself facing a state or federal charge.
Hypothetical. A neighborhood calls and says, we think this is a drug house at 1234 State Street. Is anybody looking to see whether that house is owned by the people that live there or a renter? And if it's a renter, is anybody going after the absentee landlord?
direct up before I go in too deep into where we're going. I want to steal your thunder. That's something we want to talk a little bit about this whole CAT team and assessments.
Right. We are doing some things on the south side right now with you, Indy, to figure out how we can best utilize all resources of the city to deal with these issues. And you bring up one point, but let me expand on that. Not only who owns the property, but if they're selling drugs out of it, can it be confiscated if they own it, if they've purchased that with drug proceeds? If they have children in the home, are we just taking them? Are we taking the individual and arresting? Are we not dealing with the children and the long-term impact there? We want to make sure we're dealing with that. If they have animals in the home, a lot of times they're used for dogfighting or they've been mistreated. We want to make sure we handle the criminal element. When we go into a home in the future, police department is the tip of the spear, but we want to make sure that we utilize every tool we have within our government toolbox.
239-1310 is afternoon's name. This is a community conversation about crime. When we come back, another area of crime that is increasing, particularly in the African-American community, and that is domestic violence. African-Americans are disproportionate as the perpetrators and the victims. Kelly McBride of the Domestic Violence Network is here. This is all part of a community conversation about crime. Taking a bite out of it. It's Your Life Matters Week on Afternoons with Amos. Tomorrow, youth will be here. Members of the newest NAACP branch in the city at Crispus Attucks High School. Youth branch. So we're really going to hear from the youth tomorrow. It's Afternoons with Amos after these. And we're getting somewhat confirmed, and the chief just kind of silently nodded while we've been here having this community conversation about crime. There has been an alleged homicide. It is under investigation. It is in near the intersection of 31st Street and Graceland Avenue. First of all, would somebody tell Channel 8 that Graceland is not considered... I know, it's not considered on the west side, even though it is West 31st, one or two, it's like one block west of Meridian Street. It's not the west side. It is the north side. If you're trying to use zip codes, it's 46208. But again, no further information, but one person killed around 1:45 in the afternoon, which when I looked at when homicides occur in this city, 1 o'clock in the afternoon is not necessarily a hot time.
But this is also a situation where it's not random. This is, looks like it may have been targeted.
Okay. And that's what complexes some of this stuff, when the victim knows who they are and it's targeted. And targeted crimes is also what drives a lot of domestic violence, because these are people that know each other. Kelly McBride is with the Domestic Violence Network. Kelly, welcome. Unfortunately, this is a crime that domestic violence is growing in this city and county?
Well, that's a great question. And we just released this report, Domestic Violence in the Criminal Justice System, just last month. And it was to try to answer those questions. Is it growing? What does it look like in the criminal justice system? So this is the first time we've released this report, and we just have a little bit of data right now, but it does seem to be maybe on the rise just a bit.
As we talk about these community conversations in the African-American community, you know, we've been having these conversations about violence. What do we do? And everything is always in the context of it's either young people or young adults doing it and doing it to each other. These are crimes where the preponderance of the victims and the perpetrators are African-American males. But we seem not to look at the other problems of violence and crime, which include domestic violence. And when I looked at the report, I was really shocked and stunned that 40 to 45% of the victims of domestic violence in this county and the perpetrators are African American.
Did that surprise you all? Well, I think it's a yes and no. I think it can be a bit misleading because this is just looking at the criminal justice system.
Right.
So those are only those who are accessing police intervention. That's not to account for anyone who might seek help outside.
Right.
What we do know is, I mean, domestic violence is across the board. It doesn't necessarily affect one race over the other. It's just who are they calling for help?
Chief, in terms of sensitizing law enforcement that responds to domestic runs, which are, officers have taught me and told me over the years, are the runs that they fear the most responding to a domestic situation. What's being done to improve the training? Because there's some people in the community that assume that when police officers come up on a domestic situation, they're coming with the attitude that the male is always guilty and the female is always innocent.
Can you imagine a decade, well, maybe longer than that, maybe 20, 30 years ago, I think Director and I would agree that we would tell a guy, take a hike, go cool off, go get a drink, or go, you know, go to your friend's house and then come back and later on we'd be coming to a homicide. We come light years ahead. We're light years ahead of where we weren't used to being, where we didn't take care of the victim. And what we're learning now is that the purple sheet, everyone hears about the purple sheet in the district. They know they have to fill out this sheet. If we have any evidence to show that domestic violence exists on a call or a run, we want to make everyone aware of it right away. Why? Because unfortunately, we have come back to scenes where kids have seen the parents beaten over the years and only come and get a call on 911 from a 10-year-old saying the mother or father is dead. We had to stop the violence because you're right, it starts in the home. So the idea of educating police officers to be proactive, working with groups like this and House of Roof and others, I mean, of the Julian Center and others, made it very clear early on that this is something that's mandated by the police department.
Do we need, as we have, Kelly McBride, these community conversations about violence? When the physicians were here yesterday from Eskenazi Trauma Center, I asked them, you know, as we're talking about these problems of violence as a community, does the medical community need to be at the table? And their answer was an emphatic yes. As we have these conversations, does the domestic violence community advocates also need to be at the table? Because my sense is, as the African-American community is talking about this, they're not talking about including the medical community, and they definitely aren't talking about including the domestic violence community.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. We should be at the table. It needs to be a community collaborative effort if we're going to combat violence at all in any aspect. But it does, as Chief Hite say, it starts in the home. So what these kids are learning in the home, then it's bleeding out into the streets.
239-1310, 239-1310. And there was a question, Chief, you know, after the tragedy of Officer Bradway, somebody called and didn't want to go on the air. What's being done to make sure that there is backup when officers are going to a situation that could be domestic? Because, you know, the Officer Bradway tragedy was an outgrowth of a domestic run.
This is hard to say this, but I'm going to just be honest with you. We send adequate backup when we have domestics. We know what to do. But inherent in policing, I'll say this again. When you hear a blood-curdling scream coming from a woman or a family, or you hear something at the scene, instinctively you react. Mm-hmm. And I'm simply saying to you that we'll have the backup. We'll have all the necessary tools available. But you never know what's behind that door in any situation such as that. You face it with the understanding that we took an oath to uphold the law, but also to save lives. And that's what he did. He saved the life of a woman and her child so they can live. He's a hero.
One of the other issues that's coming is gangs. And I got an email at praiseindy.com, and the writer says, I have a question. First, is it true that arrest photos are public record? If so, is it possible to post pictures of known gang leaders and members in the Indianapolis Recorder and the Star News and their names? Also, do you have a list of the slang language and their meanings that parents can make reference to if they hear their children using this language? We would like to know exactly who is living among us. It's a great question.
Talking to people who are experts in the field, that means those gang leaders, former or current, would tell you that one of the things you don't want to do is glorify the gang. Mm-hmm. They don't refer to those in the circles. Don't refer to the gangs by name. They call them, use letters A, B, C, D, or E, F, G. They go through the alphabet, because recognizing the street cred means you cause attention by the crimes you commit, and if you're associated with that group by calling them out, oftentimes you give them unfair advantage. So we can identify the person, but not necessarily the threat group that way, and we're finding it's easier for us to do that.
At the same barbecue where I was talking about and trying to tell people I was going to talk to Crime Stoppers, I said I was going to talk to all y'all. And somebody recounted that they were the victim of a robbery. Somebody went in their house, stole some stuff, and the robber was dumb enough to take some of it to the pawn shop and use his own name. And so the person knew who the robber was. Saw the robber a week ago at a Redbox, one of those movie rental things. Didn't know what to do. The victim didn't know whether you're supposed to call the administrative number of the police. You're supposed to call 911. Do you turn the other way? Do you go running? What do you do? And I mentioned I was going to be seeing the director and the chief. She says, why can't they have like a one sheet that you give to victims? If you're a victim of a robbery, a one sheet that says you've been a victim of the robbery, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do for insurance, here's what you need to do for this. Oh, by the way, if you happen to see the robber, this is what you need. And I'm going, you know, now that you think of that, maybe that's something. If your business is broken in, here's the one sheet. If you're a homicide, if your family member has been the victim of a homicide, here are the things you need to be concerned. Anybody ever done that?
Well, I'm an old timer, but I remember in the old days you had a victim sheet you gave the Memorial Sergeant. We moved away from that. We provide them with that information as to what to do if they're in fact been a victim,
Steven?
And who to call, the information, complaint number was on it, report number was
but
on it.
But I think
it.
These were some other basic questions. If somebody robbed your house, all of a sudden you know who the robber was, and you see the robber in the street, yeah. What do you do?
Well, my version is you call 911,
okay.
Because if that person's mobile, the police are going to have to get there, so call.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the chief was referring to is, yeah, we used to give a card out. There was some verbiage on the back about what to do.
Right.
I don't think it went in depth. Mm-hmm. And to get one for multiple different, we'd probably have to condense it down and figure out what we could put on it.
Or even if
but
it's a
great
idea. Even if it's a brochure. But correct me if I'm wrong, from a domestic violence standpoint, when you're dealing with those who've been a victim of domestic violence, and I know there are a lot of great counseling programs that work with men and women who've been victims of that, are there things you give like a frequently asked questions?
Well, we have provided the police department, IMPD, and Speedway, Beech Grove, and Lawrence with little shoe cards that the officers can hand out to victims right. That have all that information on them.
Maybe it needs to be a bigger card.
Well, yeah, that would be huge.
a big thing. Director?
No, it's a great idea, and quite frankly, it may be something we need to look at and make sure that we're doing our due diligence and providing those services and give something. I think we've gone to smartphones, and we've forgotten that a lot of people don't have that availability. They don't know how to access information. They need something quickly. We need to look back.
Or this person had a smartphone, even if they knew that there was a page that they could go to on a website to
save
see
it on
that.
Phone, whatever. Yeah, that is something. Now, this is a example of why we have these communications.
Mm-hmm.
This gives us something that will help. And at the end of the day, in this case, right. It may have led to someone being arrested that day.
Let me go to Jason right quick, then we'll take a break at 239-1310. Hi there. Jason?
I had a addressing the domestic violence. I was wondering, does it seem as if the male, or if it's a male and female confrontation, why do the police arrive at the scene assuming that the male is the assailant just about every time? Like the male be put in handcuffs as the female gives her side of the story first, as if as if the male is automatically the suspect.
Chief?
Well, you said, well, Robert, with the understanding of being objective, you want to look at the, first of all, previous calls to the location. You want to look at the condition of both parties. If it's two people, you want to look at their physical condition, first of all. And also, it just comes down to a matter of understanding what the routine has been. It has been, is this a routine call to this location? How often time have you been to the location where arrests have been made? It's a lot of previous history, but also looking at what's being said at the time you arrive. Now, what happens a lot of time, let's face it, yes, in fact, there are injuries. Oftentimes, it may be to a female, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't initiated by the female. So the question becomes, do we arrest, if there's injuries to both, do we arrest both? Who do we arrest? In your opinion, who should we arrest? If you come to the scene and two people are injured and the police officer arrives, who should be arrested?
But is there some instances where – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jason, real quick.
Both people should be arrested. In that instance, what I'm saying, at the initial contact that the officers make, it seems as though the male is automatically the suspect before they even get to the facts of the situation.
Is that because we separate you from the person, or how do you come to that conclusion?
No, I'm just going by watching past experiences, you know, not within my personal life, but, you know, with neighbors and friends. I mean, just seeing the even watching cops on TV, you know, if you watch cops, you know, the police get out and they automatically put the male, if it's a male on female confrontation, they automatically put the male in handcuffs and then run to the female's assistance as if we here to save her. And not knowing the facts.
Yeah,
you
but
know?
Yeah, but when you look at cops, wait for the Indianapolis Metro IMPD episode and judge IMPD on how they handle on cops. Don't worry about the Orlando police; they had enough. Kelly, real quick, from the Domestic Violence Network's point of view, you have any thought of that? Because that is I don't want to say prevailing thought, but a large thought in my community, that perception.
That men are the ones who are
that men that seem to be perceived as the suspect, quote unquote.
Okay, sure. Well, men can be victims of domestic violence, absolutely, but statistics show overwhelmingly that it's females. 80% are reporting. This guy's specific incident. I don't know of officers putting in handcuffs immediately unless they're being combative.
Right.
Otherwise, they're going to separate and they're going to do their due diligence.
239-1310. 239-1310 is afternoon's name. We'll be back with our remaining moments after these. And John, you have the next to last word in the community conversation on crime with the chief and the public safety director. Hi, John. Real quick.
Hey, Amos, how you doing? I'll make this real quick. Hey, chief, my friend got a situation going on where his estranged wife, he took her into court last week and then she made some comments to him. And back in the past, he actually drugged this man by her car with a car, and he had to go to the hospital with injury and stuff. And the prosecutor went and pursued the charges against her, saying that she thought it was a stranger. Broad daylight, and they've been married over 30-some years. And now he's kind of afraid because he came out of court the other day after she got into it with him in the courtroom. She got on the phone, then this guy pulled up in the car looking at him and stuff, and she put out... So I would like to see if I can get to be able to get in touch with you so I can give this information to him because he's afraid that, you know, he might be in danger.
All right.
And Amos would ask you a question. Two things that we would ask you if I was Amos Brown was, did he get a restraint? Did he report it to the police, and did he get a restraining order?
Yeah. Here's the thing. He reported this incident that happened a couple years ago.
No, I ain't talking about a couple of years ago. The incident that happened the other day, as he reported it to the police, what happened in the courthouse, in the city county building?
This happened in small claims court.
Doesn't matter. Did he report it to the police?
No, he did not.
When did this happen?
It happened on May the 20th.
He needs to, if he thought a crime was committed in a court, he needs to report it to IMPD. And hold on, Kelly's got something else to say right quick.
If he's in fear for his safety from her, if he's in fear of his safety from her, he needs to work with an advocate. He can call any of the shelters, Julian Center, Salvation Army, Families First, and they will work with him on a safety plan and to make sure
even if he's a guy.
Absolutely.
All right. He needs to, you hear what he say? He needs to call the Julian Center. Guys can do that. If he is in fear, no joke. And make a police report. No joke.
And encourage him to do that, please, because we don't want another situation where someone's hurt that could have been avoided.
In fact, John, I'm going to make this easy for you. If you would hold on and give Chris off the air your name and a number where you can be reached during the day, because I'm pressed for time, and somebody from the chief's office will call you back and get some additional information, okay? All right. Oh, great conversation. Chief Rick Hyde of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, thank you. The Public Safety Director of Indianapolis and Marion County, Troy Riggs, thank you. The Crime Stoppers guy, we learned so much. Stephen Du Bois, we have to have you back. Have more time for that, and then we will do with the Domestic Violence Network. And we try to do that for late June. Okay. Have you all back here. Kelly McBride, thanks very, very much. Tomorrow, young people will be here, and we'll hear from them how we take a bite out of crime. I'm Amos Brown. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow, live at 1.